across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Breitlow.
Along with Greg Bobby Waukesha, meteorologist Brittany Merlot, minutes away, Todd Alba joining us later this hour, all on a busy 7 o'clock hour for this Wednesday morning, April 17th. There's a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum that has some warnings about the sustainability of our state's unique school funding system, one that relies on voters having to make up the difference when hostile politicians in the legislature refuse to provide their share of support to educate our kids. We'll talk a bit about that in our homeroom segment at the bottom of the hour. Also, we are less than 15 minutes away from hearing from a member of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee reacting to the Republican no-show yesterday on the topic of cleaning contaminated drinking water in Wisconsin. So all that and more still to come on a very wet Wednesday morning where it's 50 degrees here on Lake Wissota, 43 in Hayward, 41 in Park Falls, 46 in Wausau, Green Bay's at 51, La Crosse 57, Wisconsin Rapids 53, Oshkosh at 55, Madison already at 62 degrees, Waukesha's at 54, and now the details on the forecast from meteorologist Brittany Merlot. Brittany, how are you?
I'm fantastic. The rain outside this morning, though, was the best kind of cuddle weather. I didn't want to get out of bed.
Oh, yeah, it's true. And it looks like you're back home now after an extended stay in Illinois.
Yes, I am. Back in Wausau, getting drenched.
I was going to ask yesterday. I'm like, Brittany, are you relocating? Are you moving into your parents' basement? But you're back now. So that's good.
I'm trying to time out when the storms were hitting. So when I was going north, you know, I got to see what was happening and drive through it all. So
you are the best weather nerd. I love it.
I am. I am.
So here we are on the backside of that system, right?
Yes, we are. No more 50-mile-per-hour wind gusts. Those are in the past, thankfully. I'll tell you, I was driving in that, and I was just getting thrown across the lanes. A lot of people have that same story if you had to drive, too. So those winds are gone. Gusts about 30 miles per hour, especially this morning. They'll start to calm as we go through the evening, but they stay about 20 miles per hour throughout the next 2 days. So today, you're waking up to scattered showers. Some are heavy at times, the further north you are, especially into Eau Claire, central Wisconsin. We're getting drenched right now. Some rainfall totals are already over an inch. And as we go throughout our day today, the scattered showers continue on and off. They will start to dissipate through the evening as the system kicks on out of here. But the low pressure itself is right on our back doorstep. It's sitting right on western Wisconsin, and it's going to be pushing through the state today. So this is why temperatures are so mild right now outside, especially further south in the state in the 50s, because these are our highs, those south winds right now. But as the system crosses through the state, we are going to drop cold, in fact, below freezing for some of us through the overnight hours. So if you have any plants outside, keep that in mind. But otherwise, today we are looking at another quarter of an inch to potentially 3/4 of an inch of rainfall.
You mentioning that the system is right overhead reminds me, I didn't give credit last week during the eclipse to whichever National Weather Service office it was that was describing how you couldn't see the eclipse because there was a low pressure system right over them. And they're like, so please, when you look up, do not stare directly into the L as it moves across. And I thought that's good weather humor right there, kids.
That's pretty funny.
It was weird. Yeah. It's weird you say eclipse because when I'm looking out the window right now in Waukesha, it's cloudy straight in like the north, but there's sunshine coming from the southeast. So it looks like eclipse weather. It looks like that weird how the sun appears when it's being eclipsed by the moon. It's just very, very interesting. And I'm just, if I stop talking or if I just forget something, I'm staring at the outside right now.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. No, I love when things are very well-defined, that you can like a very well-defined front.
Yeah.
Or you can literally see the rain coming at you, you know, the rain line. I think those things are very cool.
I saw something yesterday that I had never really seen. I saw the winds at 50 mile per hour getting sucked into these storms, and it looked like these, I don't even know how to describe it, but these shear lines across the clouds going into it. It was a sight to see.
That is very cool.
Yeah.
I recall seeing a couple of cold air funnels, and you're like, wait, is that a tornado? And you know, our meteorologist at the TV station is like, no, it's nothing to worry about, but you look at it, it gets your attention.
Yeah, you know, yeah, sure.
When you see something like that. One more thing from Rob in Tigerton. He notes that it is 46, got an inch of much-needed rain. And thinking back to our last segment, he says, I love Three Dog Night. My favorite song is Black and White from the summer of 72. Well, Rob, for being such a good regular contributor, to quote Casey Kasem, here's your long-distance dedication. You say it, we play it, Rob. Here's some Three Dog Night for you.
The ink is black, the page is white.
And that's it. That's all we can play because, you know, we're running out of time and Brittany's got places to go to.
I thought about, you know, that's we were great. Talking about, last week we were talking about, what's his name? Old man, diabetes,
Wilford Brimley.
I feel like
this was like Pat Kreitlow.
I feel like, you know, I could start reading Rob's weather reports as my impression of Wilford Brimley. If you want.
There you go. Just up on screen. Take it away.
Good morning from Tigerton. It is 46 degrees and got an inch of much needed rain. I love Three Dog Night. My favorite song is Black and White. From the summer of 1972, get tested for diabetes.
I think Brittany likes it.
Now, that's by the way, I know that's a terrible impression of.
I would not have guessed Wilford Brimley. I'll be honest, but it was still funny. It still worked.
Thank you.
It was more like the Civil War, right? Like, you know, my dearest Lisa from the battlefield.
Wilford, 1862.
So contribute to us on Facebook with comments and we might read them in funny voices.
Will absolutely do that. My pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you, Brittany. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Thanks.
Bye, Brittany.
All right. We'll see you later. It is 7:13 right now. And again, coming up in just a little bit, we are going to hear from Tip McGuire, State Assembly Rep, talking about the no-show by Republicans to the Joint Finance Committee yesterday as Governor Evers tries to get progress on cleaning up contaminated drinking water that's been polluted with industrial chemicals, but so far has not had a lot of success in getting Republicans to come in for special sessions and taking seriously some of the big issues ahead of us. Greg, there was something that I had seen online, a story that I knew I wanted to share at some point here, and it's such a great little headline. One engineer may have saved the world from a massive cyber attack. And it just is one of those like very accidental discoveries where it was an engineer for Microsoft, Andre Freund, and he said he found something strange when he was running routine tests of open source software. And he told National Public Radio he ended up uncovering a backdoor that could have enabled a major cyber attack. Here's the thing. It's open source software that is used by governments, companies, banks. And so I'm listening to the story about this guy finding the flaw in it, thinking, why are so many of these institutions still using open source software? And I'm no computer nerd, but it seems to me, in this day and age, you'd want your own system for everything.
Yeah,
right?
You think these companies would be paying, you know, computer companies like millions of dollars to create proprietary software that's like secure to the hilt.
Well, what was when the Badgers were in a bowl game and we were mocking the name of the bowl because it was a company that just does internet security like that, and clearly I'm forgetting their name, but seems like that's the kind of company you would want to use. So the engineer says, I was actually trying to do something else, and the symptoms seemed weird enough that I couldn't really justify to myself to not switch into looking what was going on. Eventually figured out somebody had injected some code into a process that seemed to allow somebody else to log into the system. It could have been bank software that shuts down the banking system, or they could steal data from a system because they have access rights. He says it didn't look like a single computer hacker. It involved multiple years of work to get to the point of being able to do something so complex. He notified the right people. They hailed him as a hero. One cybersecurity expert said the world owes Andre unlimited free beer. But here's the thing that you just said about paying somebody. The open source software where the backdoor was introduced had been maintained by a single person for close to 20 years and was not being paid for it. It was kind of like Wikipedia is, you know, mostly a volunteer effort.
Cool.
It's not good at all. So I'm amazed and grateful at Andre the engineer, but
okay,
I mean, holy
let's
cow.
Not call him that.
Holy cow. I mean, wasn't this all supposed to be fixed at Y2K?
He noticed there was a real problem when he saw that the password was password.
Oh, wait, they upgraded. It was password 123. Sorry. Yeah.
That's really so cool. I mean, it's scary as all get out, but it's very, very cool. And the name of that company, ReliaQuest. We are not sponsored by or endorse ReliaQuest.
Oh, but at least you looked up the company. So thank
you. Of course.
So if all y'all could please do that before you allow our electricity system to be shut down or money to be taken out of my bank account, that would be great. Thank you so much. The Up North News Daily Newsletter is out and all Earth Month long, because Earth Day is next week. Christina Laurie writes up the newsletter and is focusing on the future and what Wisconsin leaders are doing today to keep our state going and growing for generations. Today, she writes about the Green Innovation Fund, created by Governor Evers as part of the last state budget. It's basically a green bank for Wisconsin innovators to dip into to help pay for projects that are designed to lower energy costs for Wisconsin households, reduce pollution rates, and expand access to energy that is environmentally clean and affordable. So again, you can read about that in our newsletter. Head over to upnorthnewswi.com and sign up. Click Newsroom in the top banner and get yourself signed up for that. You can also get newsletters from some of our friends around Courier Newsroom, which is the parent company of Up North News. They include our Friday guest, Kia Vakil, has one called From the Frontlines, bi-weekly political stories from key states. Our friend Mark Jacob has Stop the Presses, that tells how right-wing extremism exploits weaknesses in American journalism. Melissa Ryan has Control, Alt-Right, Delete, covering the rise of far-right extremism, white nationalism, disinformation, and online toxicity. Kyle Tharp has For What It's Worth, which tracks online trends in reaching voters online through digital advertising. And Nina Burley's American Freak Show talks about the absurdity of MAGA extremism. Head over to couriernewsroom.com to learn more. All right, coming up next, State Representative Tip McGuire. I talked to him late yesterday, shortly after Republicans were a no-show for a special meeting of the Joint Finance Committee to try to come to an agreement on releasing funds to clean up PFAS in Wisconsin drinking water. Wherever you're listening across Wisconsin on this Wednesday morning, when you're here, you're up north. Be right back. There is $125 million just sitting there. It's already been theoretically allocated by the state legislature to clean up contaminated drinking water across Wisconsin, contaminated with industrial chemicals known as PFAS. But Republicans are also demanding that the DNR be restricted from going after some of the polluters. Governor Evers and Democrats are saying no. So you have this gridlock where Republicans didn't show up yesterday for a special session of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. State Assembly Rep. Tip McGuire is a member of the Joint Finance Committee, and I talked to him late yesterday. I don't know where to start on this, Representative McGuire. It's almost cliche. Disappointing, but not surprising. Part infinity.
Yeah, I know. It's just, first of all, thank you for having me, but it is just typical inaction from legislative Republicans on some things that are impacting regular people here in Wisconsin. It's really disappointing.
I don't know the extent to which Republicans are feeling awkward about this move to continue to hold on to this money that could be cleaning up our water. I do know that there are, you know, a couple of Republicans, one especially wanting to be outspoken, and that would be Senator Eric Wimberger from the Green Bay area. And he continues to hammer this talking point that giving the DNR the funding that's in the state budget would constitute some kind of a slush fund. This doesn't strike me as helpful to classify an executive branch agency that's getting money from the state budget the way it always does as a slush fund.
Yeah, and it certainly isn't a slush fund to have money that we can allocate to municipalities to help them clean up their water and make sure that people have access to clean drinking water. That sounds to me like exactly the purpose for what DNR should be providing money to municipalities. It seems as though this is why we have a state government, so we can, you know, put these kinds of dollars together and then be able to bring them out to municipalities who may or may not have the funds to them, you know, to be able to handle big issues like this that are statewide and are large, challenging issues that are going to impact people everywhere. This is exactly why we have a state government. And so to characterize it as that is certainly not helpful.
No. And again, we have the continued talking point that somehow or another, it's innocent landowners who would be, you know, persecuted by the DNR. And I don't know that anybody on the Democratic side of the aisle agrees that the solution to that is to tie the DNR's hands. But as you hear that point over and over again, are you getting any sense that there's something else that can be added language-wise that would help hammer home the point that innocent landowners aren't going to be held responsible? Or do you feel that what's in the current language is clear enough?
Well, look, Matt, I don't understand how allocating $125 million that we've set aside to be able to deal with this issue with local municipalities is going to be impacting that at all. They may have some disagreements about legislation that doesn't impact these dollars directly. But, you know, that's something that's going to be negotiated through the legislative process. And the governor has already outlined the reasons why he didn't support their legislation. But ultimately, what we wanted to do today is allocate the funds that we have so that municipalities and others can start to deal with these problems locally. And a year ago, we predicted that this money was just going to sit in that fund because they've done this time and again. And they're doing it not just with PFAS, they're doing it with the dollars that would benefit hospitals in Western Wisconsin that are struggling to be able to deal with capacity issues and deal with all of the new people that would be coming to their hospitals. And we want to be able to allocate these funds to make sure that people have access to emergency rooms and that they have access to clean water. It's really that simple. What we heard from Republicans leading up to this meeting today is that they said, well, we don't have to show up. But the question isn't whether they have to show up. The question should be, should they show up? And they should. They should have been here today. They should have been here to allocate these funds so that hospitals in Western Wisconsin, hospitals in Eau Claire, hospitals in Chippewa, and municipalities across the state can have access to clean water, and hospitals can have access to the resources they need to be able to serve their clients. And so those people have an emergency room to go to. So those people have a hospital to go to if an emergency strikes.
And that's where I was going to go next with this question about what the average Wisconsinite who does not follow the legislature, certainly does not follow the Joint Finance Committee, but they've heard repeatedly while Tony Evers has been governor, that he has called the legislature into special session repeatedly, and that each time Republicans have basically refused. What's a typical taxpayer, homeowner, voter, what have you, what are they supposed to think when Republican legislators won't use that call for a special session to come in and engage in debate and try to find common ground and instead just sit home each time?
Yeah, well, I think that's certainly one of the disappointing things as not just as an elected official, as a citizen in Wisconsin. One of the things that I want my statewide leaders to be able to identify their priorities. I want the governor to be able to say, hey, look, here are things that I'm hearing about, here are things that communities are concerned about. And then send that to the legislature, and then the legislature has the opportunity to respond and come back with, you know, potentially alternatives. But the refusal to engage, the refusal to take action of any kind when the governor is saying, hey, here is an issue that people need to see, that people need to see we're making progress on, is really disappointing. It really is very frustrating. We're all from Wisconsin. We all, you know, root for the Packers. We all vacation in the same places. And so the government that we have here should be reflective of what people in Wisconsin are concerned about. And people in Wisconsin are concerned about PFAS, and they want to see state government do something about it. They want to see a DNR that has resources that it can provide to municipalities to help address that problem. And so whether this is a question of big government or small government, I think is ultimately irrelevant. because what this is a question of is government doing the job that we want it to do? Because people want their DNR to be able to help address PFAS in our local communities. People absolutely want that. And so failing to allow us to provide those resources to them is, frankly, it fundamentally undermines the very role of state government in Wisconsin.
Do we feel like there might be a need for, once again, some kind of a lawsuit to be filed and courts to be involved? Or do we feel like this is where Republicans are going to leave it and we'll have to wait until the voters have their say in November to see even a dollar of this PFAS money go to good use?
Yeah, so I guess I can't speak intelligently to any potential for a lawsuit or anything of that kind, but I'll say I don't think that the people of Wisconsin are patient enough on the issue of PFAS, which is poisoning communities, or patient on the issue of hospitals in Western Wisconsin for people to be able to get access to the emergency care that they might need. I don't think that we can be patient enough to simply remove Republicans from power this fall, although that is obviously always an option. I think that we, as always, need to continue to put pressure and try and get these people who are not listening to their constituents to finally realize that this is what people want, and this is part of their role in state government, is to take these resources and provide them to the municipalities that need them.
Okay. Representative Tip McGuire, thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me, as always.
Oh, and we appreciate him coming on and giving us that update. I would just remind you, it's not like the legislators who refused to come to the Capitol yesterday have anything better to do. They are a full-time legislature. They get paid a full-time salary of over $50,000 a year, and they have put themselves on a nine-month paid vacation. Brewers lost to San Diego 6-3 last night. They'll wrap up the series this afternoon, starting at 11:35 on News from the Center, WRJN and Racine, Oshkosh Air Support, and 98Q Country in Park Falls. Our homeroom segment is next. You're up north. I mentioned in today's history lesson that it was on this day in 1971, exactly 1 year after the breakup of the Beatles, that all four had solo hits on the charts, including that one from George Harrison. It's a Wednesday morning, April 17th, Up North News Radio. Back here, I'm Pat Kreitlow in Chippewa Falls. Nice to have you along. It's time for our weekly homeroom segment when we talk about the value of public education and efforts to both support it and undermine it, as the case may be, happening around our state. Today we're going to talk about a couple of different reports that have come out recently about education. One from the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction on the teacher shortage and factors that might be involved. The other is a new report from the nonpartisan think tank folks over at the Wisconsin Policy Forum, talking a bit about the referendums that were on the ballot recently, and kind of our recent history of referendums and their success or failure rates, and what can we glean looking toward the future. So joining us from the Wisconsin Public Education Network is Heather Dubois-Boronon, and from the Wisconsin Policy Forum, Sarah Shaw. Heather, Sarah, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Good morning.
Nice to have you both here. Sarah, we're going to get into the nuts and bolts of the Wisconsin Policy Forum report in a second. Heather, I was going to ask you about the DPI report on a teacher shortage that continues to be ongoing. But I think just as a way to open up the segment, you would, if not directly, you would connect the dots on these stories of, you know, what we're seeing in terms of struggles in school districts and the referendums that are increasingly on the ballot.
Yeah, I sure would. The DPI teacher crisis report that came out last week was really striking in that it didn't tell us a ton that we didn't already know about the challenges facing our educators, but really crunched some numbers on how many of them are leaving the workforce, indicating that we don't, in fact, have a teacher shortage. There's plenty of teachers, just districts can't afford to provide the conditions necessary for them to thrive in their teaching environments because they are so strapped for cash. So we're seeing all kinds of ways that this is showing up in the classroom, and it's very concerning.
Yeah, and that's where, again, the work of the Wisconsin Policy Forum comes into play to give us more of an analytical, you know, data-based view of, you know, what is the current environment for funding, not only of Wisconsin school districts, but of local governments as well. So, Sarah, can you tell us a bit about what's called your focus report for April of 2024? Folks can find it at wispolicyforum.org. Tell us about the thrust of this latest report.
Yeah, thanks. So we were looking at two major questions. First was, what were these government entities, primarily school districts, asking for in their referenda, which show up on voters' ballots and ask them to vote on whether to authorize additional spending? First, what were they asking for and how much were they asking for? And then secondly, what were voters approving? And the main thrust of what we found is that districts put more questions on the ballot for these spring elections than they have since at least 2000. So that's a reflection of financial stress that districts are facing, in addition to some other factors. And at the same time that districts are increasingly turning to referenda to ask for more money, we see voters starting to slow down in how much they are actually approving those referenda. So it's a concerning, more requests, fewer approvals trend.
Right. So to look at the, you know, the graph that's in here and to look at how you wrap up the report, it's kind of a good news, bad news, what I take away from it. The good news being that there is still, you know, if not strong, we can say healthy support for school districts being shown in these referendum questions. But the trend line is downward lately. And I mean, is referendum fatigue, is that too trite, too simple to call it? Or is that kind of what we appear to be facing in these numbers, Sarah?
It's a theory that we've heard raised that is starting to look like it might be true. So we've seen numbers declining in approval rates for the past several years. Where we are right now, there were 60% of referenda in the February and April elections that were approved. That's still over 50%. And it's still higher than what we saw in most of the late 2000s and early 2010s, when approval ratings hovered more around 50%. But then starting in 2012, we start to see voters approving referenda in greater numbers. And in 2018 was the peak of this trend, where we saw 89.7, almost 90% getting approved. So comparing this year's 60% so far to that, we really do start to see a potential for maybe voters aren't willing to continue paying for what districts are asking for in order to balance their budgets.
And one more on the types of referendums, and then I want to get Heather's reaction to all of this. But again, there are two distinct types of school district referendums. There's the ones that people are used to hearing, capital referendums. We need to build a computer lab. We need to build a gym. We need to build a school. We need, you know, to retrofit. We need a new furnace, whatever. But increasingly, we're seeing operating referendums, which is basically, we're not building anything, but, you know, we're so low on funds, we need you to vote to raise our taxes just so we can keep the doors open and keep paying the light bill. Those operating referendums have taken off like a rocket here, Sarah.
We saw 66% of the referenda on the February and April ballots were operating referenda. And that's the highest share of referenda that are operating since at least 2000. As you say, these are when districts are asking voters to authorize more spending for them to help pay for ongoing district costs. That can happen in addition to a district finding ways to cut costs, or it can be about maintaining, this is what we're spending and we feel like that's where we need to be, or we need to be spending even more.
All right, Heather. Well, there's all the data. Still strong support, but it may be waning. A whole lot more operating referenda questions on the ballot. A legislature that, as you've pointed out repeatedly, hasn't kept up with inflation for 16 years. When you look at all of this, what should be the message to voters and taxpayers in Wisconsin when they take in all the total of this study and this political environment?
Well, I think voters need to remember that if they don't like going to the vote ballot box to raise their taxes on themselves to fund their public schools. They're going to have to go to the ballot box in November to elect some new leaders in Madison who are going to make sure that the next budget actually does provide for the needs of local kids. I think Sarah's right that it may be too early to tell if referenda fatigue is really at the root of the dip in passage rates this year. But we are seeing a wide range of factors. One is low spring voter turnout. There are people who didn't really know what was at stake for local kids or how urgently needed the passage of some of these school referenda were. There was a lot of disinformation and misinformation out there, confusion voters have on, you know, was this a historic budget for public school kids? We're hearing confusing rhetoric on that from our elected leaders at the Capitol. And I think voters don't really understand why they have to keep picking up a bigger piece of the share if the state is sitting on such a big surplus and allegedly has been, you know, giving money to public schools. That's why we need groups like the Wisconsin Policy Forum and the folks who are connected to us through our network to help educate voters on the fact that this budget actually did not, in fact, create a great boon for public schools, but rather left them shorthanded and in a crisis situation, whether it comes to whether they can pay teachers enough to keep them on staff or whether they need to reduce their programs and resources that are going to be made available to kids.
One of your compadres at the Wisconsin Public Education Network, Chris Hambuck Boyle, makes note on Facebook, you know, the funding is so dire that touting a historic increase in public school funding isn't the truth, given 30 years of defunding, especially Act 10, you know, moving forward. But the other factor that I want to ask you about is the degree to which, yeah, there's been more investment overall into education, but the voucher program has grown so much more. Has that played a factor in the need for more operating referendum because of, does that make the cash flow tighter for public school districts?
Absolutely. That just squeezes more money off the top of the pot. And let's be honest, we are actually not, in fact, investing more in our public schools. When you take the state's percentage investment in education total as a percentage of GPR, it's lower than it was 20 and 30 years ago. And so that's really not a true talking point. The dollar amounts might be more, but that's simply because of inflation and the massive amount that we're giving to these programs that play by a different set of rules and actually drain resources away from our public schools. We're seeing the impacts of that all over the state.
Now, this is happening not just with school district referendums, but local governments as well, Sarah. And the study does go on to explain that, you know, these property tax levy limits imposed by the legislature, they work a little differently for, you know, municipalities, counties, and technical colleges. But we're seeing what I guess I would call out of shorthand, kind of the equivalent of a school district operating revenue referendum. And now you've got local governments saying, look, if we're going to keep the fire department and emergency medical services staffed at the same levels, now we need to go to taxpayers and ask for more funding. And is that what we're seeing an increase in as well?
So in the municipal side, we typically have seen through state law a tie toward net new construction, where a municipality's ability to raise more is really tied to how much more they are building, which in some cases is a way of regularly receiving more revenue to meet municipality needs, and in other cases, it's not. And both here and in school referenda, two key factors are whether staffing needs to be at the same levels. While potentially on the school side, we see a decline in school enrollment across the state. So as school enrollment has declined, staffing levels across the state have actually remained fairly level, which can create strain for districts that are trying to maintain levels of funding for those teachers while having less funding coming in the door because fewer students means less money. So that's one factor here. And then another factor is that inflation that Heather mentioned. So we've seen increases in state funding in some budgets, but on net, they have not been sufficient to be able to keep pace with inflation, especially when we saw historic highs in 2022 and much of 2023.
And so along with the enrollment numbers and, you know, demographics, there is also pandemic, you know, COVID-19 relief funds, you know, that came through local governments and school districts. And now what's the significance that we're kind of moving out of that phase or that bubble or what have you? Is it as hard as some predicted it might be? Is it worse? Is it not as much of a factor?
The phrase that's been getting used is a fiscal cliff. And in Wisconsin, compared to other states, it might be sharper because the state legislature did not increase revenue limits, which are districts' most reliable and largest source of funds to help meet inflation. And so districts found themselves in some cases choosing between using those federal relief dollars to be able to support COVID needs or using them to plug normal operating budget holes. And so now in the federal aid is going away at the end of September, these same districts are figuring out, were there things that we were doing that were really helping to meet COVID needs? And can they now go away? Or do we feel like we still need to maintain them? If we want to maintain them, then we get back to this question of, okay, so are we cutting costs elsewhere or are we raising revenue elsewhere? And if they were used for plugging holes, well, now you've got holes. So this is the push-pull that we see district administrators working with.
And so, Heather, I mean, you already have a messaging hurdle on any given referendum, but now you've got to explain, you know, when people say, well, wait, what happened to all that pandemic relief money? It's not making the job of public education advocates any easier.
No, none of this is easy. None of it is simple or easy to explain. But kind of the bottom line truth is, kids are paying the price of these cuts. Kids are the ones who are teetering on the edge of this fiscal cliff. Kids are the ones who are tripping up in those holes Sarah was talking about. And so if we keep our focus on the kids and what kids need and let voters know exactly what really is at stake when these questions come to us on our ballots, I think we can trust voters to do the right thing. We have seen this all over the state. When people get organized and they take time to get a team together, really educate folks, get out there, knock on doors, and let them know what the referendum means and why voters are being asked to support it, they tend to pass the referendum at much higher rates. So we'd love to help people get organized to do that.
All right. And thankful to be a part of that on our homeroom segment. Heather Dubois-Bornon from Wisconsin Public Education Network. Just continuing our Beatles theme today, Greg, I guess.
You played the solo singles of the Beatles, so I thought I'd play their first big single together.
Oh, very nice. All right, thank you for that. Todd Alba is with us now. You hear him weekdays noon to 2 on the Civic Media Radio Network. Mr. Alba, how are things going?
It's a beautiful day. Had a little rain down here in Madison last night. A couple of storms got a little severe. Haven't heard of a whole lot of damage yet, but maybe. But all in all, you know, it's a beautiful spring day. And today, Patrick, in Madison, the annual rite of passage, the sunburst chairs, are being brought back to the Union Terrace on campus. It is spring in Madison.
It is. It is maybe that and the Dane County Farmers Market showing up on Capitol Square are like the 1-2 punch that says spring's here, like it or not. Here we are.
That was last week, and of course, Saturday was picture perfect. Mm-hmm. And it was. I went up there; it was packed, but it was a beautiful day.
So we've mentioned a couple times that during the perfect weather last weekend, I've been doing this garage project, which involves, you know, putting up sheetrock and we're going to paint it and make it all look nice inside. Well, the sheetrock finally went up yesterday, and you know, most of the time that gypsum board is white, you know, or maybe a light gray, however you want to describe it. Well, we wanted the stuff that was a little bit more mildew resistant, and it apparently doesn't cost that much more. And without further garage, that's probably, you know, you don't want mold or anything out there. And they said, okay, that's fine, but it doesn't come in white. It only comes in green or purple, and the green isn't available. And we're like, okay, well, we're going to paint over it anyway, but we haven't yet. So for now, the inside of my garage looks like a dream man cave for every Minnesota Vikings fan that's out there. Or, I have the purplest garage or the biggest Prince fan, you know, one or the other.
I was going to say, welcome to Donny Osmond's dressing room.
Donny Osmond. There's the other one. Yes.
That takes us way back.
You can call it Paisley Pat Park.
Paisley Pat Park. That could work as
that
well.
Was so dumb. I'm sorry, everybody.
No. You are just fine. Yeah. Let me indulge me for a moment. I forgot a couple of promotional notes, and I don't want to forget. Tomorrow we have our Women Win Wisconsin segment, powered by Motherhood for Good, and we're going to be meeting with a legislative candidate from the Fox Valley, from the Oshkosh area tomorrow. And I wanted to wish a happy trails to Leanne Stapleton over at WEAU 13 in Eau Claire. She's been anchoring the early morning news with my friend Bob Gallagher for a couple of years now, and this is her final week before she moves on to a job in Portland, Maine. And you gotta love anybody on TV or radio that's got, you know, what you would call an infectious laugh. And so never mind. She's a perfectly capable news anchor, but you know, when they're talking to like Bob Bolsold from Wax Radio or whatever, and you hear that laugh, and it just lifts your spirits, you know, when you hear people like that. So
absolutely.
I didn't want to forget those things. Oh, what are you following on the show this week? I have been beating the drum on PFAS in the water, of course, and the hospital money, you know, that's supposed to come to the Chippewa Valley. So,
and frankly, Todd, Pat's bumming me out.
Todd, the Republicans who are okay with contaminated water are bumming me out. Tell me you've got something refreshing to share with us.
Well, we have Pat Kreitler and Trigby Olson.
You got that. Yeah, they're good guys.
Today on Wednesday. And then we have an exclusive interview with the comedian Kathy Griffin. Not Kathy Lee, but Kathy Griffin. She's playing at the Overture Center. And, you know, I mean, she's to some folks a controversial figure, but I encourage people to tune in at 1:30 because I found her a fascinating interview, and I think perhaps a side of Kathy Griffin you haven't seen before. So we've got that at 1:30 this afternoon, in addition to yourself and Trigby.
I wondered, I noticed over on the Twitter machine that my mentions were suddenly piling up, and I'm like, what? And I went over and looked, and here I'm listed in the same post as Kathy Griffin. And I'm just like, oh, well, there's a pairing I never thought that I would see.
Right? I mean, she's been, you know, she kind of got canceled after she
went a little too far with Donald Trump humor.
Yeah, right. The mask and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But she's also gone through through cancer, and her voice has actually permanently changed because she's now cancer free. And I found the most fascinating part of the interview. She's actually spent time performing in the USO tour and has performed in war zones. And to hear Kathy Griffin talk about what it's like to do stand up for men and women in uniform while she's being literally bombed, not bombing, but literally being, it was fascinating. Mm-hmm. So I encourage people to tune in and perhaps hear a part of Kathy Griffin's life that you haven't heard before.
All right. I have to ask you about this. Earlier in the show, we talked about how Carrie Lake from Arizona, running for U.S. Senate, still in denial about losing the governor's race, but made reference to strapping on a Glock and putting on the armor of God, you know, again, in embracing the violent rhetoric. But what I hadn't mentioned yet was how Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson is comparing himself to a wartime speaker. He said what he's going through is comparable to the Civil War, but maybe worse. But maybe worse.
Well, it's like Trump saying that, you know, he had it the roughest of all presidents, forgetting, of course, that Lincoln was assassinated.
Right.
I mean, that's what these people do. And
I mean, it's almost a messiah complex with some of these folks.
Almost.
Well, it just shows how.
Almost, for some of them. Not, I mean, Trump is a full-blown messianic, you know, thing here, but the rest of them are not far behind.
I think it just shows how unserious of a candidate they are and how unserious they are about their politics. And we talked about this a little bit yesterday, the fear, the Trump fear factor. You may have seen Pat, Heather Cox Richardson, the great historian and author, had a piece this week where the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Foundation decided to vote not to give an award for courage to former Congresswoman Republican Liz Cheney because they were afraid that a potential second-term Donald Trump would take away their tax-exempt status. I know, and one person on that board had the courage, a photographer, a Pulitzer Report prize-winning photographer, resigned and wrote a scathing resignation letter taking these people to task. So it's the fear of Trump at that level. It's the fear that, Trump is ginning up things against Megan Wolf, our elections official here in Wisconsin. She has to have extra security. And now these people in Washington, like Mike Johnson, I believe they are fearful of Trump and Trumpism. And so they basically do whatever he wants them to do.
Yeah, and it's getting very serious. In fact, I've still got Heather Cox Richardson's latest book, Democracy Awakening, sitting right here on the desk because I've contemplated like doing almost a book club type thing, a weekly segment where we would look at one chapter of the book because it's so well done. So again, yeah. Heather Cox Richardson, Democracy Awakening, highly recommended. And thank you for bringing that up, Todd Alba, who we will hear again from noon to two on the Civic Media Radio Network. Thank you, sir.
As they say on Hee-Haw, salute.
Which one of us is picking and which is grinning? Well,
I'm picking.
Wouldn't that be great?
Oh, God. It would be dangerous. Thank you, Mr. Bach. We'll catch you on Matt and Air on Air. Thanks to all of you for being a part of Up North News Radio for this Wednesday. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow.